It's my very great pleasure to be welcoming to the stage at the Treehouse Robert Cohen. Robert is a forthright blogger, a leading dissident voice, and he takes a Jewish but not Zionist position on Palestine and Israel. He spent 10 years as a reporter for BBC News, and for those people who know Greenbelt's relationship to the Amos Trust, and I think the Amos Trust have a stand in the Greenbelt takeaway, he is a trustee of Amos. So welcome, Robert.
Hello, thank you very much. It is very good to be back at Greenbelt. This festival has meant a great deal to me over the years. We first came here as a family to Greenbelt in 2007, so this is our 10th year here. And things happen when you come to Greenbelt, I suspect as many of you have experienced. I first came here solely on the basis that I could hear Billy Bragg, and that was the only reason I agreed to come. And then 10 years later, I'm standing here as Claire was saying, as one of the UK's leading Jewish dissident voices. Actually, I have to own up. It's not that difficult to be one of the UK's leading Jewish dissident voices. It's a very small field. So you're lucky to have me, okay? However, Natalie Bennett is just over there if you kind of change your mind halfway through. Since last November, I've been speaking to groups around the country about the Balfour Declaration, which was issued by the British government 100 years ago this November. And the thing about Balfour is that it's still not history. It's current affairs. The consequences of Balfour are still being played out today, and nobody can tell you how it's going to end. Apparently, Donald Trump is going to make a deal, and it's going to be the best deal in the world, in history of deals. In fact, he had his top people over in the Middle East just last week. I've no idea exactly what this deal looks like. I'm not sure that anybody does, in fact, but it's going to be a really beautiful deal when we actually get it. Trust me, he says, I'm in real estate. Now, personally, I find it very hard to believe that a president who has brought such chaos and division to his own country will be the man to bring justice and peace to Israel-Palestine. It just doesn't quite work in my head. And if he thinks that Israel-Palestine is just about real estate, then he's got an awful lot to learn. Theresa May wants to make deals too. She met the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, in Downing Street in February. And I think Mrs. May did mumble something about settlements being obstacles to peace before they got down to the real business of the meeting, which was, of course, business, trade. Because we in Britain now need all the trading friends that we can get, because we're about to dump the ones that we used to have. I'll come back to Mrs. May a little bit later. But everything that we are seeing today, whether it's in London or Washington, Ramallah, Jerusalem or Gaza, can be traced back to the Balfour Declaration in 1917. And when I've been talking about Balfour, I've been dedicating my talk to the wrong kind of Jews, by which I mean the awkward Jews, the dissenting Jews, the troublemaking Jews, the ones who stubbornly and annoyingly for some get in the way of things and generally try to disrupt the approved Jewish leadership narrative. I'm talking about Jews like me and others that have spoken here at Greenbelt over the years, like Jeff Halper, Ilan Pappe, and Mark Ellis. Being the wrong kind of Jew can be a thankless job, but as I hope you'll see, you can still play a very influential part in history. Now, when I tell organisers that the talk I want to give is called The Wrong Kind of Jews, they often get a little bit nervous, understandably. They're already anticipating that phone call from the Board of Deputies accusing them of giving a platform to anti-Semitism. So I have to reassure people about the title and explain that this isn't a phrase that I've made up. Actually, by the way, Greenbelt didn't bat an eyelid when I said that's what I wanted to call the talk. But green belt, they get it. So the wrong kind of Jews. It's a phrase that I've borrowed from Chaim Weizmann, a man who knew all about Jewish troublemakers. If you've heard of Arthur Balfour, then you definitely need to know the name Chaim Weizmann. And in terms of the Declaration of 1917, you really can't have one without the other. And in fact, I think in November, we ought to be marking not the Balfour Declaration, but the Balfour-Weizmann Declaration. Otherwise, it's a bit like remembering Rodgers without Hammerstein or Elton John without Bernie Taupin. You just don't get the full show or the full song. Weizmann, who was the future first president of the State of Israel, met Arthur Balfour, the former Conservative Prime Minister and future First World War Foreign Secretary, for the first time at a Manchester hotel 10 years before the Balfour Declaration. Weizmann describes the encounter in his autobiography, Trial and Error, and at their first meeting, as it ended, Balfour said to Weizmann, "It's curious, the Jews I meet are quite different from you." And Weizmann paused for a moment, and then he answered, "Mr. Balfour, you meet the wrong kind of Jews." So I'm going to introduce you to some of the wrong kind of Jews 100 years ago and since, in the hope of showing you that there's always been significant Jewish dissent around Zionism and the actions of the State of Israel. And I believe the attitude of the wrong kind of Jews can give us some guidance on how we should commemorate the centenary of the Declaration this year and what advice we should give to Theresa May and her Foreign Secretary. But let's start by reminding ourselves what the Declaration says. It's just 67 words. I'm going to read it out for you. Normally, I can do this with slides, and I can put it on a slide projector, but I'll read it out to you. I know lots of you would have heard the Declaration and read it many times, but let's just read it again. "His Majesty's government view with favour the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavours to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country." 67 deliberately vague words that get blamed for a great deal of trouble, and rightly so. But before we get too enraged, let's acknowledge that Balfour is a very impressive document. What's impressive is that there is so much going on in so few words. It's even richer in cultural and historical resonance than President Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, which, by the way, is 272 words long. So you're really getting diplomatic value for money with the Balfour Declaration. You can only understand what's going on in Balfour by studying British imperialism, the international power politics of the First World War, misconceptions about the influence of the Jewish community in Russia and the United States at that time. You need to study the history of Western European colonialism. You need to look at 2,000 years of Christian Jewish relations. You need to look at 19th century Christian Zionism. You need to look at Enlightenment ideas about human rights. And you need to look at the divisions within the Jewish community over the best response to centuries of European anti-Semitism and the rise of European nationalism. 67 words. Luckily, you've got a couple of months still to get really kind of stuck into all this. Lots of books that I could recommend. Now, a well-known summation of the Balfour Declaration was made some years later by a Jewish writer called Arthur Koestler, who described it as a document in which one nation solemnly promises to a second nation the country of a third nation. Now, although pithy and memorable, it's a tidy summary, but it does have its own failings. For a start, could you, in 1917, call the Jewish people a nation in any meaningful sense relating to modern nation states? As we'll see, many Jews in 1917 said, no, you can't, and you shouldn't even try. The Palestinian position in 1917 was also more complex than Koestler's soundbite. They weren't a nation state either, they were subjects of the Ottoman Empire, but they did have the moral advantage of being the majority on the land for more than 1,000 years, and they had the title deeds of ownership. Not that any of this stood for much once Britain had made up its imperial mind. Nor does it count for much today among Christian and Jewish religious Zionists who look to the Bible to provide the ultimate in estate agent documentation, which pulls rank on all other paperwork. By the way, if you want to know more about Arthur Balfour, I'd like to recommend a book. And normally you're meant to plug your own book when you come to Greenback. I'm not plugging my own book. I'm plugging a book by Warren Bardsley, who is sitting just down here. Warren's written a fantastic book called Consequences, The Trial of Arthur James Balfour. There are copies in the bookshop. Is it that way or that way? I can't remember. Anyway, it's very close to us. I would highly recommend it. It's kind of like a cross between Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol and Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life, in which Balfour is confronted by the consequences of his declaration 100 years on. And wouldn't it be great if we could do that to politicians in real life? No, it'd be terrific. Anyway, it's a great book and it's a great idea. So how should we commemorate the Balfour Declaration? Is there anything to celebrate, or is it just a dark moment in British imperial history that many are still paying the price for? Before I get onto that, though, I want to tell you a bit more about the talented, charming and very skillful diplomat that was Chaim Weizmann. In the years leading up to the Balfour Declaration, the Russian-born research chemist was teaching at Manchester University, at the same time as becoming a leading figure in the still small Zionist movement in Britain. And it was Weizmann who led the negotiations with the British government, and Weizmann who succeeded where Theodor Herzl, who's considered to be the father of modern political Zionism, had failed. Weizmann got an empire, in fact the global superpower of the day, to back this radical project for Jewish nationalism and physical salvation and collective Jewish renewal. It was Weizmann, rather than Herzl, that shifted Zionism onto an entirely new level. And there's no doubt that the Balfour Declaration was the point when Zionism became supercharged. It was no longer just a dream or a theory or just an ideology. It was now an achievable project for which a program of action could be mapped out, and Weizmann over the coming years set about doing just that. Now, by the way, if you think the Balfour Declaration is really terrible, you should see the first draft. The first draft was not written by the Foreign Office, it was written by the leadership of the Zionist organization in Britain, and it was sent to the Foreign Office to consider in the summer of 1917. And if that version had gone through unchallenged, then history would have been very different. That first version made no reference whatsoever to anyone else living on the land and proposed that there would be a British protection for Zionist colonization without interference while a Jewish state-building apparatus was put in place. So the Balfour Declaration's wording by November was considerably watered down, due in part thanks to the wrong kind of Jews that Weizmann blamed in his autobiography for making life more difficult for him. But Jews like Weizmann believed absolutely in the righteousness of Zionism, as do most Jewish people today. Weizmann firmly believed that he was embarked on a project that was utterly essential for the Jewish people, that it was high-minded and it was just. And if you want to characterize Zionism as just a form of racism, then you're really failing to understand the political and historical context out of which it emerged. And it meant far more than just finding Jewish people a safe home free from anti-Semitism. Zionism for Weizmann was not merely primitive tribalism, as he believed his Jewish anti-Zionist opponents imagined it to be. Jewish homelessness and anti-Semitism was not just a physical discomfort for Weizmann. Zionism was much nobler. As he said in Trial and Error, Zionism had an inner significance, and it's had a constructive, moral, ethical, social character for Jews as individuals, as well as a nation. So this is Zionism as a psychological as much as a physical and territorial issue. Now, Weizmann first came to prominence and the attention of the British government through his laboratory work at Manchester University. He'd been working on a way to produce acetone through a fermentation process that uses carbohydrates like starch and glucose. I got a C in my chemistry O level in 1982, so that's about as complicated as I'm going to be able to get on explaining acetone for you. But I do want to give you a very brief chemistry lesson, and I want you to just stick with me on this just for a moment. Acetone was important because it could be used to make cordite. Okay, cordite is what's called a low explosive, a bit like gunpowder. It can be used to propel a bullet through a shell to its target without destroying the barrel. So if you could work out how to mass produce acetone, then you could be a great service to the British war effort. Now, Weizmann was at pains to say that the Balfour Declaration was in no way a gift to him from a grateful nation at war. And I would agree that that would be far too simple a way of telling the story. But in my mind, there is a link, at least a metaphorical link, between Weizmann's chemistry and designism. Okay, are you following me? Welcome to my laboratory of the mind. Stick with this for a moment. Okay, so take a pinch of Judaism, a dose of anti-Semitism, and a dollop of European nationalism, a colonial view of the goodness of Western civilization, a sprinkling of communal psychology, and then start a fermentation process. Okay, out of the other end comes Zionism, and it's a pretty potent concoction. Now, Britain's current chief rabbi would certainly object to my chemistry lesson, but if I'm a poor chemist, then I think Ephraim Mervis is surely a worse historian. I'll come back to Rabbi Mervis in a moment. These days, when you talk about Zionism in pro-Israel circles, you're not allowed to use language like colonialism or, worse still, settler colonialism. Writing in The Guardian recently, the novelist Howard Jacobson said, "Zionism took many forms, but neither conquest nor colonial expansionism was one of them." So there's another Jewish commentator on Israel with a shaky grasp of history and indeed Zionism itself. 100 years ago, Zionist leaders like Chaim Weizmann had no problem in articulating their ideas in terms of colonialism and settlements and bringing civilization to the East. They weren't embarrassed or queasy about this kind of language because it was so embedded into the Western European outlook on the East. But how typical was Weizmann's Zionism within the British Jewish community 100 years ago? Did his view of the Jews as a nation in desperate need of a national home reflect a Jewish consensus? At the War Cabinet meeting during which the declaration was approved on the 31st of October in 1917, Balfour told his fellow cabinet ministers that the vast majority of Jews in Russia and America, as indeed all over the world, now appear to be favorable to Zionism. But, to use a modern phrase, that was fake news. This is the aspect of the 100th anniversary of Balfour that comes as a surprise to many people. Jews, wherever you found them in 1917, were, on the whole, not Zionist. When you listen to the discourse around Israel and Zionism today, and what it does and does not constitute in terms of Jewish identity and anti-Semitism, it's almost the exact opposite of the debate that was taking place 100 years ago. Now, this is critical to understand if you want to challenge today's rigid definitions of being Jewish or caring about Judaism, or what the definition of anti-Semitism should be. Weizmann spends a great many pages in Trial and Error describing not Arab, but Jewish opposition to Zionism, the wrong kind of Jews. Am I keeping you up? You're not drifting off, you're doing well, thank you. Opposition was articulated mostly from the well-established, well-off Jews in West London, but the impoverished Jews of Whitechapel were hardly Zionist advocates either, not in 1917. And unlike today, you could travel almost the entire religious Jewish spectrum without meeting a Zionist. There were many competing ideas as to how to respond to being Jewish and combating anti-Semitism in the early years of the 20th century. And in the Jewish East End of London, you would have found Jewish communists and Jewish socialists and Jewish anarchists. And within this immigrant political cauldron, you would have found Zionism too. but you would not have put your money on that particular ism being the one that would triumph. Actually, I don't think it ever did really triumph. Not in Britain, not really. What won the day for British Jews was not communism, socialism, or Zionism, but a different ism, aspirationism. A better job, a nicer home, family security, the respect of neighbours. In fact, the same kind of aspirations expressed by poor and oppressed people all over the world. The thinking of many East End Jews would have gone something like this. Why leave Whitechapel to go to Palestine when if we work hard we can get a semi with a small garden in Ilford or even Finchley? Isn't that perfectly good Jewish ambition? Isn't that Jewish self-determination? Oh, and by the way, Mr. Weitzman, my moral, social and ethical character is fine, thanks very much, and I'll see you in synagogue on Saturday morning. Hard to believe in 2017, but in 1917, it was perfectly acceptable to be non or even anti-Zionist without anyone calling you a self-hating Jew or being accused of being out of line with thousands of years of Jewish teaching. In fact, the exact opposite idea that Zionism was just the flip side to anti-Semitism had far greater currency. After all, the Zionists were insisting that Jews had no place and no real future living among the nations of the world. Even though it came from a very different direction, that view chimed with a great deal of anti-Semitism. So let me introduce you now to some of Weizmann's wrong kind of Jews, the ones that helped to influence the final draft of the Balfour Declaration. David Alexander was president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews between 1903 and 1917. He also served as vice president of the Anglo-Jewish Association. He was also president of the Jewish Working Men's Club and served on various other notable Jewish institutions of the day. So about as not like me, okay, as a Jewish establishment as you could possibly get. On the 24th of May 1917, Alexander was a co-signatory to a letter to the Times, along with other Jews, in which they set out their grave objections to the Zionist ambitions. The letter rejected what they saw as the conflation of nationality and religion. And just to read a little extract from the letter to the Times, they wrote, "The Zionist theory regards all the Jewish communities of the world as constituting one homeless nationality incapable of complete social and political identification with the nations among whom they dwell. Against this theory, we strongly and earnestly protest." Now, the letter goes on to recognise, with, I think, in hindsight, painfully accurate prediction, that Zionists would give Jewish settlers in Palestine special rights in excess of those enjoyed by the rest of the population. Now, meanwhile, Orthodox Judaism viewed the whole Zionist project as usurping the hand of God, attempting to hasten the arrival of the Messiah. Now, although the British chief rabbi of the day, Joseph Hertz, was a Zionist, he was out of step with most of his rabbinic colleagues. For Judaism, exile had always been understood in religious and spiritual contexts. It was not merely a physical dislocation from ancestral land. There was much more to it. Our behaviour had put us in exile from God, and we had to work our way back into his favour through prayer, study, and good deeds. God would decide when the exile was over, not us. And that's why in 1800 years there had not been an organised mass movement to return to the promised land. And it's why Zionism needs to be understood as a radical departure from Jewish thinking up to the 19th century and not a natural development of prayer book liturgy. Meanwhile, on the non-orthodox end of the Jewish religious spectrum was the voice of Claude Montefiore, who was the leader of the liberal Jewish denomination in Britain. Montefiore observed this. He said, "Is it not, to begin with, a suspicious fact that those who have no love for the Jews and those who are pronounced anti-Semites all seem to welcome the Zionist proposals and aspirations?" Now, that particular quote could have been written to describe some of President Trump's inner circle in the White House and indeed many of his grassroots supporters. It also works for some fairly unpleasant far-right political leaders in Eastern Europe today, and it's proof that you can be pro-Zionist and anti-Semitic simultaneously. Meanwhile, in Lloyd George's wartime cabinet was a man called Edwin Montague, a Jew who was strongly opposed to Zionism, which he called a mischievous political creed untenable by any patriotic citizen of the United Kingdom. Can you imagine any member of the cabinet saying that today, let alone a Jewish one? Montagu thought that Zionism was anti-Semitic, and he succeeded in modifying the language of the final draft of the Declaration to make sure that it did not disenfranchise Jews living anywhere else in the world apart from Palestine. In his memo to the cabinet, he set out his objections. He said, I assume it means that Mohammedans, Muslims, and Christians are to make way for the Jews, and that the Jews should be put in all positions of preference and should be peculiarly associated with Palestine in the same way that England is with the English or France with the French, and that Turks and other Muslims in Palestine will be regarded as foreigners, just in the same way as Jews will hereafter be treated as foreigners in every country but Palestine. Wow. He really understood where this project was heading 100 years ago. Now, contrast all of this Jewish ambivalence towards Zionism 100 years ago with where we are today, and the evidence that was given by our Jewish leadership in the United Kingdom to the Home Affairs Select Committee for its report into anti-Semitism that was published last October. Chief Rabbi Ephraim Mervis told that parliamentary committee, Zionism has been an integral part of Judaism from the dawn of our faith. You see, I told you he was a terrible historian. Earlier in the spring of 2016, he'd written in the Daily Telegraph that Zionism was a noble and integral part of Judaism. In fact, one of the axioms of Jewish belief, and that one can no more separate Zionism from Judaism than separate the City of London from Great Britain. Meanwhile, Sir Mick Davis, who was then chairman of the Jewish Leadership Council, told the same parliamentary committee that criticising Zionism is the same as anti-Semitism. And this is how he argued it. He said, Zionism is so totally identified with how the Jew thinks of himself and is so associated with the right of the Jewish people to have their own country and to have self-determination within that country that if you attack Zionism, you attack the very fundamentals of how Jews believe in themselves. And I would have to agree with Sir Mick's assessment, and reliable research into Jewish attitudes and Jewish understanding of identity backs up exactly what he said. But how did that happen? How have the criticisms that Alexander and Montefiore and Montagu, how have they been so easily forgotten? Now, what we've seen over the last few generations is a deliberate muddling of the scriptural, biblical use of the word Zion and the modern political project of Jewish nationalism called Zionism. So much so that political Zionism and Judaism have undergone a kind of seamless merger. We've successfully muddled a religious and historical connection to the promised land of our scripture with a nationalist project of colonialism. And we can no longer tell the difference between the two, and we use one to justify the other. It begs a much bigger political and philosophical question about whether a belief held by the majority within one particular group means it becomes sacrosanct, holy, and therefore untouchable. But what happens to that sacrosanct understanding of being Jewish when another people have experienced the same sanctification as a catastrophe? The Balfour Declaration marked the beginning of this journey towards a new Jewish identity. Now, you can't begin to understand that seamless merger without understanding something about the Jewish Holocaust and the ongoing trauma that it has created in Jewish life and outlook. The sense of Jewish abandonment by the world during the 1930s and 40s remains strong today, while the arguments for depending on welcoming, tolerant, multicultural democracies feels weak and naive to many Jewish people. Even if we like where we are, at the back of our minds is the idea that if the going gets tough, there's somewhere to go that won't close its doors in our face. And looking at 20th century history, it's an understandable conclusion. And added to this is the what-if school of history. What if there had been a Jewish state in 1933 or by 1940? How many millions of Jews might have been rescued? It's all very powerful and compelling rhetoric. And if you challenge the iron logic of eternal victimhood and national salvation, you're again trampling on sanctified ground. but I don't buy into this anymore. I think it's a poor historical understanding, I think it's poor politics, and I think it's very bad for your mental well-being as well. Ultimately, narrow ethno-religious nationalism doesn't bring you safety. In fact, the history of the State of Israel has proved that to be the case. And I think there are different lessons that we can draw from the Holocaust, and they are universal lessons rather than nationalist ones. But where does this new post-war Jewish identity leave a dissenting non-Zionist British Jew like me, who thinks that Edwin Montagu and Claude Montefiore not only understood the full implications of Zionism better than the Zionists themselves, but they also predicted its consequences? Balfour led directly to the establishment of a Jewish state, and the creation of that state dispossessed another people. How else could such a project of return on the scale of millions and with the priority of national self-determination based on majority rule have been achieved in any other way? This was always going to happen. However noble and high-minded Zionism was in its desire to lift Jews out of oppression, this was always going to turn out badly for another people. Because the fundamental problem with the project was that Palestine was not, as the Zionist slogan put it, a land without a people for a people without a land. And in truth, it didn't take the first Zionist pioneers settling in Palestine very long to understand this. For the Jewish people, it has been a story of return and renewal, and of literally rising from our own ashes. But if it's you being dispossessed, you're not going to see or experience Zionism in quite the same way. Now, for a long time, I used to think that the whole problem was about competing narratives and opposing nationalisms. I was what you would call a liberal Zionist, critical of the occupation, but fundamentally in support of Zionism. But after years of reading and listening, and finally meeting and talking to Palestinians, I changed my mind. It's true, the problem is complex and the history is long, but it's actually simpler than people want you to think it is. Israel-Palestine is, thankfully, not a religious conflict, although sometimes I think Benjamin Netanyahu sounds keen to turn it into one by branding all Palestinian attacks as ISIS-inspired anti-Jewish hatred. Some Christians also want to turn it into a religious conflict. The latest mailing that I received from the UK branch of Christians United for Israel, you need to understand that I just kind of get these mailings because I want to know what they're on about and what they're saying, not because I agree with them. I read what came through the post the other week, and it informed me that the violence over the Temple Mount last month should be understood, and this is a direct quote from their leaflet, as a spiritual battle between good and evil, a conflict which has been going on for millennia. Now, if it really does become a religious conflict, then we're all doomed, I suspect. So today, I don't think it's a religious conflict. I don't think it's a nationalist conflict either. I think that ended in 1948. It's certainly not a conflict between equals. It's not half a dozen of one and six of the other. It's not, well, a plague on all your houses. And it's not a case of, if only they could sit down and get to know each other better and sing songs together and build bridges, then everything will be fine. So what is it all about? I think 100 years after Balfour, it boils down to this. Who has rights and who does not? Who takes those rights away and who protests and resists? Who is treated well and who is treated badly? Who has power and who does not? And then to check that you've not misread the situation, count the house demolitions, count the homeless, count the orphaned, count the maimed, and count the dead. And then decide which side should feel most afraid and least secure. In every other part of the world, calling for human rights and equal rights is a pretty uncontroversial thing to say. But when it comes to Israel, such talk is disloyal and heretical if you're Jewish. And if you're not Jewish, then you're accused of promoting the destruction and genocide of the Jewish people. It's all certainly a very odd state of affairs, one where the victims of an occupation and an annexation and a siege are consistently represented as the aggressors and the terrorists, and where all forms of resistance, whether violent or non-violent, are considered equally illegitimate. The British government makes no serious attempt to challenge this way of looking at the situation. And our Jewish leadership in Britain choose to focus on examples of Palestinian incitement and hatred of Jews without the slightest attempt at historical or political context. They just hate us all, and that's about as sophisticated as their analysis gets. As a result, they consistently represent the symptoms as if they are the causes. Some things are certain, though. There is no going back to a time before Balfour. There is no pre-Zionist Palestine to return to. Jews and Arabs will both be part of the future landscape. But for everyone to move on, my belief is that we Jews have to let go. 100 years after Balfour, it's time to let go of Zionism and see it as it is, a false messiah, another golden calf, a moral cul-de-sac, an aberration in our history, not a continuum. We need to unpick the tangle of Jewish identity that we've arrived at, which is currently reinforced by a Jewish leadership that fails to see where it has led us. And what about Theresa May, who's still hanging on in there, last time I looked? I thought I might have to change the title of this talk after the general election, but she's still there, just about. When it comes to the Balfour Declaration, Theresa May set out her position in a speech to the Conservative Friends of Israel last December, and she said that the UK was entering a special time, and she described the declaration as an anniversary we will mark with pride. There will certainly be no apology. The Foreign Office has already responded to that demand and announced that the Balfour Declaration is an historic statement for which Her Majesty's government does not intend to apologise. A full assessment of the declaration and what followed from it can only be made by historians. But as I said at the beginning of the talk, it's not history, it's current affairs, and that's the problem. So where are today's wrong kind of Jews, and what's their advice on how to respond to the centenary of the declaration? In Britain, we have a very small Jewish community, about 360,000 people. That's about 0.5% of the population. That means it's very difficult to build a critical mass of internal Jewish opposition to the standard party line on Israel. So it can feel like a fairly lonely place to be when even mild-mannered, polite Jews like me get branded as rabid radicals for talking about equal rights. In America, it's a very different story. There you're seeing a generational fracturing in attitudes towards Israel. Younger Jews raised on liberal American values and a Jewish ethic of compassion and the value of equal rights have run out of patience with Israel and have built an active movement of protest on campuses. The question is whether they stay within their communities and in time become the new leadership, or if they just opt out of formal Jewish life. So what to do? The wrong kind of Jews need to form, in my opinion, new friendships and new alliances. We need to make common cause with like-minded people, first and foremost, the Palestinians themselves. People like Mahanad Al-Kaizeh, who's been at Greenbelt this weekend. Some of you, I'm sure, have heard him talking about planting olive trees as non-violent resistance. And with the Jewish Israeli left, like Zahar Vardi, who's also been here talking about her experiences of resistance against the Israeli military, and she in fact went to prison for refusing to serve in the Israeli Defense Forces. The wrong kind of Jews need to support churches and mosques who are willing to challenge Jewish interfaith dialogue when it becomes a collusion of silence over Israel. It means supporting the work of Sabil Kairos UK in its attempts to promote responsible investment by churches across the country so that they're not inadvertently funding the occupation. We need to call out real anti-Semitism when we see it on the left and on the right, but protest when criticism of Israel is used to close down legitimate debate or, worse still, undermine an entire political party. And this November, it's about making sure that the Balfour Declaration does not continue to make Palestinians invisible. That means talking about the purpose of the Amos Trust's Just Walk pilgrimage to Jerusalem, which, unlike the Balfour celebrations that will be taking place in London, will give voice to the people that Balfour described as no more than the non-Jewish communities living on the land. Being the wrong kind of Jew today means challenging and pushing against the acceptable parameters of the debate within the formal Jewish community. It means articulating a path towards a new understanding of Jewish self-determination that recognizes that our freedom and security will always be linked to the freedom and security of all people, and in particular, the Palestinian people. During 2015's visit to Britain by the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, he was given a trip to the British Library to look at documents of special relevance to Jewish history. And you won't be surprised that the Balfour Declaration was one of the documents he wanted to look at and was shown. But what if he could have shown Prime Minister Netanyahu an updated version of Balfour, a version that took account of all that has happened in the last 100 years, a different 67 words, but closely based on the original. If you like, a kind of a rewrite of the Balfour Declaration by today's wrong kind of Jews. So I thought I'd have a go. I thought I had to rename it, so I'm calling it the Boris Declaration. So here it is. Her Majesty's government view with favour the establishment in Palestine, Israel, of a safe and secure home for all who live there. The nations of the world should use their best endeavours to facilitate the achievement of this objective, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil, political and religious rights of Jews or Palestinians living in Palestine, Israel or any other country. 67 new words that might just get us out of all the trouble and pain that we've created in the last 100 years. Thank you very much.
Robert, thank you. Hello. You're up for questions. Thank you very much. You're up for questions? Questions. Do you want to pick the hands? Because I get very stressed by having to do that.
Hey, who wants to ask? Gentleman at the back in the blue shirt.
Oh, thanks.
Sorry,
yeah.
You've got to
walk. Go for the back first.
I was in Israel for the third time a couple of months ago, and certainly I heard more about the Balfour Declaration. I even went on the Tel Aviv Bauhaus architecture tour, and somehow they managed to shoehorn it into the beginning of that, obviously missing the bit about respecting the rights of, etc. But I probably heard more about the 67 war, and I just wonder how that sort of unhappy coincidence of the two anniversaries and the 50 years between them sort of impacts one on the other.
I think you're certainly right. In Britain, I think we heard more about the June 1967 war, and it was positioned in terms of a moment when Israel was under great threat, and that led to the unification of Jerusalem and the celebrations of Jerusalem as a unified city, as a Jewish capital. We heard very little about the occupation and the settlements. I think that's very true. It's interesting how much we will actually hear about Balfour come November. I think there's a lot of interest in Israel and Palestine. I'm not quite sure how much the British government will really make of it. We're not sure whether Benjamin Netanyahu is going to come to the UK to be part of the celebrations. It's difficult to know whether the UK government will think that's a good idea or a bad idea. But yeah, there are so many anniversaries this year. You know, it's the 67 war, there's Balfour, there's 10 years of the Gaza siege. There's a lot happening. It all seems to have come together in one particular year. The woman with the green belt T-shirt.
Hi. I was interested in what you were saying about the research into anti-Semitism, that actually for the majority of Jews now, to speak against Zionism and speak against Israel, they feel it's anti-Semitic, even though, as you've shown historically, there's no historical connection. But where does that leave us in walking that very difficult path of wanting to speak out against the effect of Zionism in Israel for the people of Israel and for the people of Palestine, but not wanting to be anti-Semitic?
I think you've really kind of nailed it. You've really kind of hit the thing that makes this whole conversation so very difficult, in that it's hard to criticise Zionism as a political concept now without also being accused of being anti-Semitic. And I think there's been a very deliberate attempt in terms of the pro-Israel lobby and Israel itself and those that want to support the state of Israel to make that happen. And if you and some of you might be aware of the definition of anti-Semitism that the government has adopted that includes that that point about the fact that, you know, you cannot say that, you know, you cannot criticise the idea of Zionism and Jewish self because that's criticising Jewish self-determination and that's therefore anti-Semitic. So it's extremely difficult and you have to choose your words very carefully. I could talk for much longer about how we do that. I'm happy to talk to you afterwards about but it's a huge challenge, and it's probably the most difficult thing about this whole debate is to steer a course where it says that you're not anti-Semitic, but you're not happy with what's happened over the last 70 years. Are there any other... What's... You're back. Yep.
Thank you very much. Very interesting and inspiring discussion. I, too, have recently returned from Israel-Palestine and work actually with a group from Amos. And the it's 40 years since I'd worked actively in that region. During the time that we were there, we visited one of the refugee camps, Ader, and were subject to a gas attack. We were trying to put on a performance at the Bethlehem Festival, which was cancelled due to the troubles that had been on Temple Mount a week earlier. My question to you is, having just been there and seen the very, very sad situation that has developed for those people, particularly since 1948, how can we here, other than just sympathise, saying let's all be friends of Palestine and we'll listen and come to Greenbelt and wear T-shirts and so on, how can we support the wrong kind of Jew in our community in order that we can help facilitate change for the better?
Invite me to come and speak. I think there are positive things that you can do, and I think it is about, as I was trying to say at the end there, broadening the permissible boundaries of what is acceptable to say when you're talking about this issue, and not allowing the Board of Deputies, because they do this and they try and do it to me on occasion as well, to stop other voices being heard. So I don't deny that the Jewish community is Zionist and is overwhelmingly Zionist, and how important that is to 21st century Jewish self-identity. But that doesn't mean that they then have the permission to actually control the entire narrative and to say that no other opinion can be heard. So I think from my point of view, it's about not being bullied or intimidated by people that try and close down debates and meetings and conferences that take place. I think in terms of what you can do with your own church, I think there are things that you can do in terms of supporting Kairos Sibyl, in terms of looking at divestment opportunities within your own community. But I think the key thing is just allowing in your own communities a broader spectrum of opinion to be heard.
Thank you. Some years ago, I approached Grant Shapps. He was my MP. He rose later to become chairman of the Conservative Party. He's now fallen from grace. But when I've got into discussions with Zionists, they try to express their superior knowledge of history. And Grant Shapps was able to do that to me some years ago. And since then, I've educated myself, and I've read the books, I've watched the films, and I used to volunteer in the Palestine Museum in Bristol, which any of you have ever go to Bristol, it's well worth going to see. And I was there one afternoon, and a chap came in, and we were talking about the foundation of Zionism in 1890, modern Congress in Switzerland in 1896, the modern foundation of modern Zionism, political Zionism. And we're chatting away. And he said, well, I'm Jewish. It'd taken 20 minutes to see whether I was anti-Semitic before he told me he was Jewish. You've got to educate yourself. You've got to read the books, you've got to watch the films, you've got to visit. Help with the olive harvest.
Hi, thank you. I've recently started converting to Judaism, and I just wondered what place is there for me in this discourse. I don't want to go blundering in and say, like, all of you people are wrong. These are actual right ideas. It seems not the best way to ingratiate myself as I go in. Like, should I be awkward or should I not?
I think only you can answer that question. But I appreciate the situation you're in, and I would tread lightly. And it's probably perhaps not the thing at the top of your agenda right now.
Okay. I don't know if this is a question, but I'll say what I'm going to say. So we heard not that long ago there were members of the Labour Party that made statements about Israel. Ken Livingstone said that Hitler's government was in conversation with Zionists, and then he was accused of being anti-Semitic because he'd put the word Hitler together in the same sentence as Zionists and Jews and Israel. And he was suspended from the Labour Party. But we haven't really heard that actually he was, the fact that he was historically correct hasn't been given nearly as much publicity as the, you know, the so-called infringement and what happened to him. And I'm just trying to link things up with what's been happening here, certainly for me today. So I've been with the Seven Beats Collective, and we're looking at the Beatitudes. And something that came through today was very much about speaking truth to power, and that also connected with what Jack Monro was saying. And I'm just thinking how easy it is that once you get slapped down for speaking out, you are really much more wary about doing the same thing again. And I just wanted to say that to all of us, really, that, you know, it's tough, it's a struggle, and it's almost like you have to cope with being slapped down and told that actually even non-violent resistance, using the boycott, you're being told that's wrong now when it comes to Israel. So, you know, try to find that truth and that honesty within ourselves that actually there needs to be some kind of resistance. And we need to keep going with it, to keep going with the boycott and other forms of nonviolent resistance. And it's up to all of us to commit ourselves and to stand up and to be ready to be counted.
Thank you. There's a woman in a blue dress sitting right at the back.
I've got a rabbi friend, and he talks about, he posts on Facebook a lot of pro-Palestinian things. And he talks about Magna Zionism, but so what is Magna Zionism? How is it different from other sorts? Sorry, secondly.
Okay. Judah Magnus was a rabbi and a teacher that was working and living in Jerusalem from the 1930s, 40s. And he tried to develop a version of Zionism that would try and reach an accommodation with the Palestinian Arab community at the time. And he had great reservations about Zionism, the version of Zionism that became dominant, that was a Jewish state-building approach to Zionism. He could see that was problematic. There are other people at the same time. Martin Buber, the philosopher, is probably another prominent Zionist who thought similarly to how Judah Magnus thought. They were a bit ahead of their time, to be honest. They didn't kind of get the support and the traction that they needed. And their understanding of Zionism wasn't the one that won out. But they're very interesting people, and they're worth reading and looking at.
You've got 2 minutes left, so maybe one more question.
Okay, so we'll go. I'll let Warren talk. I've already plugged your book, Warren. I'll give you more airtime.
Well, I was going to say, where am I going though?
Thank you very much, Robert, for commending the book. The check is in the post.
Thank you.
But what I wanted to say very briefly was that a feature of this book is that the second part is written in the form of a drama. And I've made it into a play, which can be performed very easily by churches, by church groups, either as part of an act of worship or separately. And sometimes one of the best ways of getting the truth across is through this kind of drama. So if anybody wants the... Oh, go and buy the book, by the way. It's in the bookshop. But if anybody wants a copy of the play, then just give me your email address and I can send it to you. And there's no copyright. OK? Thank you.
Brilliant. We've actually got one more minute.
One more minute? OK. So we have one more.
Yeah, it's obviously quite hard to be quick with such a contentious issue, but I respect what the lady said to my right as well. But yeah, as a person who observes Sabbath now as well, and kind of is aware of the heritage that the Gentiles have brought over the thousands of years and how it's kind of all culminating in a great way, I just want to say what you said about America is very true. People who keep some of the Hebrew traditions there, I just wanted your opinion, really, on that, in terms of the fact that the narrative that the Zionists have been pushing for like over 100 years or whatever is actually, they're losing ground on that basis, in terms of people coming to the real realization that Yeshua, Jesus, is the Messiah. And yeah, that's all I really wanted to say, which is that, you know, the history books have been, in a way, kind of dictated by the rulers or the winners, and therefore... the possibility that the Palestinians do have a right to stay in the land and all the rest of it. You know, I'm just kind of putting that out there, really. And I once again commend you for your talk and as a person of the Jewish community. And yeah, that's what I thought. I'd just like to say how exciting it is that people are coming back to Torah and mikveh being the baptism. And, you know, yeah, it's just something that's a great thing that's happening. Thank you.
Thanks so much. I think we're out of time. Can I just plug the panel that I'm on over in Pagoda in about half an hour with Peter Oborn? You might have heard him this morning, really interesting guy, coming from the right, but very pro-Palestinian as well. And also Zahar and Muhannad, who I mentioned in the talk, you may have heard as well over the weekend. And the four of us are talking on the subject of one state, two state, no fit state, I think is the title. So if you can stand to have a bit more Israel Palestine before you go home, then come and find us over in Pagoda in about half an hour. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you, Robert.